Last week, as I said, we were kind of looking at what is often seen as one of the most contentious parts of the book. And really, just to recap, because it's useful here, what we saw last week was another aspect as we looked at the church age. We saw another aspect to God's triumph over Satan, and we got this other focus of whatever was happening to the church. And as we know from the book of Revelation, the church is often hard pressed. The saints suffer. Whatever else is going on, the actual reality is the church is winning. Satan doesn't have it his way, does he? There was this interesting aspect we've seen. I was talking on the phone to my brother earlier in the week, and the concept we kind of came up as we had our discussion is Revelation is a group of pictures which illustrate something. They don't necessarily all fit together perfectly. I don't think they're meant to. That's not the aim of the book. But the point is this. In one of these pictures, the focus is this. Satan's limited. He can't do what he wants. He can cause trouble. He can cause persecution for the saints. He cannot stop the message of the gospel spreading, because it spreads, and as we were looking at this morning, it spreads by God's will, doesn't it? Not by our efforts, which is hugely encouraging, isn't it? So we saw that, didn't we? But that's really now, in a sense, it's taken us over the sort of peak or brow of the mountain. We've been through all that hard stuff. We've been through the world history and the church age and the difficulties that are suffered by God's people. And now we come to the future. In Revelation 20, we see the coming of Christ, we see the judgment, and now we see the future. What's ahead for God's people? You know, every now and again you sort of have, you come across, you tend to get it on these chat show things in the day, of course, you know, when I've caught something just before the news or something like that. And you get someone on and they've made some amazing lifestyle change or something like that, or you get them in the Hello magazines and stuff like that. You know, something do the rich and aimless. And you often get that these people have done something quite remarkable. They may have lost a lot of weight. They may have, I don't know, made a huge career change, started some mega enterprise that's been very successful. And what strikes me about that is that very often when we look at these people and what they've done, it's as much about what they don't do as what they do do. And when we look at this chapter and the future of the church, it's as much about what is not there as is there. Hopefully you understand that as we go on. Well, what do we learn first of all? I've got three titles tonight, and they're all to do with God's people. A new start for God's people, a promise to God's people, a proper home for God's people. Let's start off with a new start for God's people. And interesting enough, it's kind of what we'd expect. As I said, we've seen the toil, we've seen persecution. We saw, didn't we, the terrible chapter 13, where there's the beast of the earth and the beast of the sea, and God's people really are having a terrible time. And there's the picture, isn't there? There's that scary sort of phrase that as we look at it, we think, how can this possibly happen? And, you know, it's this incredible blasphemous beast from the sea. And it says he was given power to make war against the saints and conquer them. And we think, gosh, how can God let that happen? But listen to this. John says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. We think, oh, this seems an interesting detail. Well, just think of it. Jews were never really a seafaring nation, were they? They didn't like the sea. To them, it represented disorder, chaos. And it's no, coincidence that when the sea's been mentioned in Revelation, that's where trouble comes from, isn't it? You know, just chapter 12, the dragon's on the seashore. Why is he there? Because this hideous beast, this persecutor of God's people, is going to come out of the sea. The picture's been, as it often was for the Jew, trouble came from the sea. Nothing good came from the sea, did it? And so here we get, in that simple phrase, a wonderful picture. There's going to be an end to chaos and the persecution, the kind of rough and tumble that the church is facing at this time. You know, one of the things I think was quite interesting, when I was talking to Paul Williams, who's the vicar up at this church, doing fantastic work in Sheffield, Christ Church, Forward Sheffield, is he said, you know, my name goes on Facebook. I'm very cagey about what I put on Facebook, and I'm careful. And his reason is this. They can have a go at me, but they can't have a go at my family or children if they don't know they exist. Well, what does that tell us? He expects trouble, doesn't he? Because of the stand he's making on various things, stands that are not held by the bishop of that particular diocese and stuff like that, he expects trouble. He expects he's going to get one in the neck. Most likely from the church as from outside the church. And that's the picture, isn't it? Just imagine then for a second, here's a place where that chaos is gone. And actually what we're seeing as we see the holy city coming down, which as we see it's the dwelling place of God's people, it's the church glorified. What we start to see, which is predominant in these last chapters, is there's a recreation. The first heaven and the earth have gone. But there's something happening. God is making everything new. And that's interesting, the phrase that's used. When we get this promise that's given, a trustworthy and true promise, because it comes from God, is making everything new. And actually the Greek word for new here means new in character. Now, it's not just a remake and remodel of the old world. It's not a rejigged version. It's a new version. It's a new version. Because if we skip back a bit, there's been recreation in verse 2 and 4. For the former things, some can translate that first things, the things that have been and are now past, have passed away. And I think that's very significant, because what we're seeing now is that the curse that was made of sin, which led to the end of Eden, the end of the earthly paradise, that's been reversed. Everything about it has been reversed. How do we know that? The dwelling of God is with men. And that's something we know after Adam and Eve's sin could not happen. What happened? The relationship they had with God was damaged. They hid. They were driven out of Eden. The relationship was gone. This picture, there's a rather interesting picture, which I think is quite an interesting one. Some people, you may have heard the phrase the garden temple. And the idea that's sometimes given is that the perfection of creation is in the garden temple. And Adam, by tending it, was to extend it. So the glory of God filled the world. Now, that's an interesting, there's arguments on both sides of that. But, you know, here we are. We're getting back to that picture, aren't we? We're getting it. This new world is that garden, that city extended in a way that Eden never wasn't because of man's fall. And again, why is it trustworthy and true? Well, quite simply, because a promise has been fulfilled. There's a couple of references in Isaiah. If you're making notes, you can note the other one. I'm going to read from Isaiah 65, verse 17. But you could easily look at 66 and verse 22. But Isaiah 65:17 says this, "Behold, I will create new heavens and new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind." And that's quite for a quite simple reason, isn't it? The glory of the new heaven and earth will just vanish them from our memory. So there's a new start for God's people. You know, the past, the suffering, the difficulties the church has faced, that's gone. Secondly, there's a promise for God's people. And this, I think, is very interesting. You know, when I look at Revelation, there's, as I said, I think I said back in the early sermons, there's kind of two reactions to it. You've got people who basically will never go near it because they've just experienced some of a crackpot or weird ideas. And they just think, I can't handle this. Which is a great shame, because the books actually we read at the start is meant to encourage us. Or there's the other one that gets so obsessed. But I'll tell you what they get obsessed with. They get obsessed with all the stuff after the seven churches. Which is a great pity. Because actually all the stuff after the seven churches to hear is connected with that first bit. Look what we got here. It takes us right back to the beginning of the book. When you read what God is going to do. Look at verse 6. He said, "It is done. I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. He who overcomes will inherit this. I will be his God and he will be my son." Now that takes us, as I said, to the start of the book. Why? Because quite simply it's using phrases from the start of the book. Verse 8, "I am the Alpha and Omega, the Lord God." This is chapter 1, verse 8. "Who is and who was and is yet is to come, the Almighty." And later on he says again, verse 17 and 18, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. And then he placed his right hand on me and said, 'Do not be afraid, I am the first and last, I am the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades.'" And actually, those phrases there are very much how, you know, the method by which we've got to this part of the book. Because what have we seen? Christ is the first and last. He is the sovereign over all creation. One of the things we were meant to take from the middle of the book, which is a great pity because people don't, they basically sort of seem to like giving themselves the heebie-jeebies over what various plagues and signs mean, is that God's in control right the way through. It's at his command. It's at the Lamb's command that the seals are opened. It's at the Lamb's command that the bowls of wrath are poured, the trumpets are sounded. Actually, it's going to be hugely encouraging, isn't it? That's the picture, isn't it? He really holds the keys to death, Hades, and everything. So there's a promise. And basically, the promise is this. He who overcomes will inherit all this. Now, where have we heard that phrase before? Well, with each of the seven churches. The summing up, whether they'd done good or bad, was always to he who overcomes. And then God would give a promise. To the faithful in each of those churches, there was something to look forward to, often connected with being God's people. A pillar in God's temple was one, wasn't it? In the town which was used to earthquakes, where people never had any sense of permanence. How permanent to be a pillar, a support in a building. That was the picture there. Here's the picture. A new name written on a new stone. The stones that used to be close to the breastplate of the priest. A new place in God's kingdom. That's the picture. And here's, there's going to be a free gift. It's a wonderful picture. A drink without cost. the water of life. That's very, very reminiscent, isn't it, of Jesus' conversation with the Samaritan woman. Jesus answered her, this is John 4 verse 10, Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God, who it is who asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." Verse 13, Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." And here we are. Here we are. The promise is fulfilled, isn't it? That's why it's so trustworthy and true. So this is a wonderful thing, isn't it? There's a promise. There's a reward for those who persevere. You know, one of the things I cannot get my head around, and it's a sad thing, I think, now, is that there seems to be, you know, obviously I could talk about the prosperity gospel. They'd be a prime target for this verse because, you know, there's nothing about overcoming there. It's all about sort of basically seeing God as an open checkbook. But, you know, what I think I'm really struggling with now, and I'm seeing it more and more in the church, is very much the point of view that God accepts everyone. For the liberals now, and, you know, Steve Chalk and people like, what constitutes sin? I don't know what constitutes sin to these people, because it just doesn't seem to be there. You know, I suppose they'd say it's murderers. Suppose they say it's the sexually immoral. Or, I don't know, but then sexual immorality, well, you know, they kind of got that one muddled up, haven't they? Maybe some of these things they say, well, it's the vile, it's the paedophiles or something like that. But the point is this, just read this verse. And this is important because whereas there's a wonderful promise to God's people, on the other hand, verse 8, but the cowardly, the unbelieving, that's interesting, isn't it? The unbelieving, just general unbelief. The vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, and the idolaters, and all liars, their place will be the fiery lake burning sulfur. This is the second death. You see, for heaven to exist, there actually has to be a hell. Because there is this thing, isn't there? There's no place for anything that is unholy in God's new creation. Why? Well, as we were saying, it's new in character. It doesn't have good or bad in it. It can only have good. And so this is something we have to take seriously. And this is the thing I think we also have to do. It's not a question of people being particularly bad. It's the unbelieving, isn't it? Those who reject Christ. And I think that's important to note. So we have a promise to God's people. Lastly, we have a proper home for God's people. Now, again, I think that must have been a tremendous encouragement when these letters went out to these churches and they would have got their letters and the actual rest of the book. For some of these churches, we know they were facing intense persecution. And it really must have been hard. It really must have been a test to them as to how they balance that with the promise of future glory. You know, one of the things I think we often miss, because we're not Jewish, when we read the book of Hebrews, is that we sort of think, why does he keep going over the same point? Well, how can these people think of going back to Judaism? Well, I'll tell you why they were doing it, because we get a hint in the book. They were having a tough time. They're having a really tough time. And they were saying, in Judaism, we can see the priest do the business. We can see him do the, you know, stuff on the Day of Atonement and sprinkle the blood and say the prayers, and we all go away feeling good. But Jesus Christ, we've heard about him. We've never seen it. We've never seen it, and we're getting a tough time. And basically, they were saying, where's our reward? We want it now. We want it now. And I don't think it was different for these churches, was it? It wasn't. You know, that was the case. They were suffering. They were having a difficult time, many of them. But the key thing is now we start to see it's going to be a proper home for them. Rather interestingly, this part of the book very much mirrors the last section of Ezekiel where he's taken to the city. And again, it's interesting, isn't it? It's, in Ezekiel, he is taken in the spirit. And here, John is taken by this angelic guide. Come, I will show you the bride and the wife of the Lamb. And John noticed, he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. What do we deduce from this as John witnesses the new Jerusalem, the church? Well, the first thing we notice is this, it's a union. It's a proper union between God and man. And we see that very clearly in verse 3. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men. He will live with them. They will be his people and God himself will be their God. That's again a phrase that turns up in Ezekiel when this people are in exile, when they're sort of far from the things of the Lord or Jerusalem or where they believe the Lord is best worshipped. God makes a promise that there's going to be a coming back. And actually that's just a mirror, that's just a sort of mirror image, you know, of what we're seeing here. God's people being with God forever. The unity, and this is a phrase, you know, something I want to sort of very much sort of centre on. The unity that we saw in Eden, because the motifs of Eden will get stronger and stronger as we go through the rest of the end of the book. So that's the first thing. No gap. No barrier between God and his people. And actually, this is a contrast. Because we've seen in Revelation before, we've seen another city, haven't we? We've seen various cities. We've seen a Jerusalem, a Babylon. And the Jerusalem and Babylon further back in the book has not always been portrayed in a good light at all. In Jerusalem, when the two witnesses come, they're persecuted there. You know, they slay God's witnesses. He is the imperfect. Babylon is the impressive. It's the worldly power, isn't it? It's the picture of success. And we see that God just flattens it, finishes it, judges it. And here's the picture, isn't it? The worldly powers, the powers, and you know, this would have been very poignant. Remember, of course, when we look at a book like Revelation, it speaks volumes to the people who first knew it. The ones who were giving them a hard time, Rome, the Roman world, who was persecuting them for being Christian, this is passing. These cities will not last. There's an eternal city. And this is such a big contrast. This is so different, isn't it? 15 to 17, we see a very curious picture, 11 to 14. This, what are these are supposed to convey? Well, 11 to 14 is this, when this rather interesting part, again, very similar to Ezekiel, where they measure the city, where they're looking at it. It's showing that actually it has a perfection to it. The pictures, the dimensions are very similar to the temple. It's the meeting place of God and the people again. And the other thing is this, that the way it is, and the precious jewels and materials that are used show a perfection to it. I find it quite interesting when you get to the foundation, even the foundation's made out of precious stuff. It's incredible, isn't it? There's gates, easy access for God's people. Why God's people? Because the names of the tribes are on the gates. This picture of God's people, the 12 tribes, the 12 apostles, here we see it. We see the church. We see a home for the church. It's perfect, it's glorious, it's large, it's big enough for everyone. And that is a huge encouragement, isn't it? It's the picture, isn't it? It's the picture of those heroes of faith. In Hebrews chapter 11, there's old Abraham on his extended camping holiday. He never had a foundation under him. Tents don't have foundations. But he had a mind of a place that had foundations. This wonderful picture. All these people were looking for something permanent. This is wonderful picture in 2 Peter as he talks about the tent of this body. He's going back to that picture of the patriarchs wandering around with their flocks and stuff, never really having a home anywhere. You know, where do they end up? Well, Jacob ends up with Joseph and the 12 brothers down in Egypt. They've got to wait for a home. Yeah, they have one. They're taken later by the Exodus to the Promised Land. And there's a picture, really, isn't there, of the Christian's journey. The difficulties, the temptations, the struggle in the desert, the need and dependence of learning to have a dependence on God. And then going to, in terms, an earthly paradise. Not perfect. Pictures of what God has intentions for us in the end. I'm never fully perfect, but it illustrates where we're going as Christians, doesn't it? And this is perfect. So it's a wonderful picture. It's perfect, it's glorious, and it's a home for God's people. But before we sort of leave this chat, this sermon tonight, I just want to really emphasize again the two verses. All that is for, as it says in verse 7, for he who overcomes. Only those who overcome, only those who will struggle, only those who keep going and are faithful will inherit all this. There's going to be a separation. The cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexual immorality, and all those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and all liars, their place will be the lake, fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. So there are two homes, aren't there? Really, there's two destinations. There's a home for God's people. One of the things that, you know, I think can be a misconception that's been peddled in certain areas of the church is you come to Jesus and suddenly all your problems are solved and everything's fine. No, actually, I think you generally pick up more difficulties. That's the picture, isn't it? It's not an earthly paradise being a Christian, but there's a glorious promise in the future. The easy way is to just do your own thing, isn't it? And actually, that's what verse 8 of this chapter is all about. Those who do their own thing without time for God, they will have a place, they will have a home. But it will be outside of God's goodness. There'll be none of the common grace they see in this world. There'll be none of the benefits of living in God's world at all. All that will be taken from them. All hope will be taken from them. Because there is no touch of God there at all. So we need to pray, really, don't we? We need to also be inspired, because this should encourage us to witness, you know. In a town that really, I think, half the time doesn't really want to notice us, let alone listen to us, it is the urge to get going, isn't it? Because, you know, if we have a good thing, we want to share it. And we should certainly want to share it to avoid the alternative, which is what those who don't believe will face. Let's pray.